Hello, this is Stephanie.
And this is Brian.
Welcome to the making and the remaking of A Codependent Mind. In this episode, Brian will be reading Chapter 4, Toxic Relationships. Also, if you're enjoying listening to the book, we would very much appreciate a review on Amazon. I put a link to the review page in the show notes. Now here's Brian.
Chapter 4, Toxic Relationships. When it comes to defending the narratives they've built about themselves, narcissists will often resort to extreme measures. This is such a common feature of narcissism that there's actually a term for it, narcissistic abuse. The abuse takes on many forms: emotional, psychological, physical, financial, sexual, and is pervasive in their day-to-day interactions. However, there are more acute abusive or controlling behaviors that go beyond the everyday when they feel the need to lash out in order to maintain or reassert control. These behaviors include verbal abuse like condescension, belittling, insulting, coercion, volatile rage like shouting or throwing things, contempt or constant criticism, physical violence, and manipulative behaviors like gaslighting or stonewalling. I experienced some of these abusive behaviors in my friendships with narcissists, and I certainly experienced most of them with my first two romantic relationships. I was late to the romance game, but when I joined, I wound up in two back-to-back relationships spanning 12 years with abusive, narcissistic women, first R and then J. Both of those relationships started in a way that is apparently a page right out of the narcissism playbook: love bombing. Love bombing is when a person is subjected to a destabilizing bombardment of attention from a potential romantic partner or friend, often in the form of constant and relentless communication. It can include being showered with compliments, care, gifts, whatever has the biggest impact. Relationship beginnings. R and J's love bombing was extremely disorienting, and I had almost no defenses against it. Both times, I was emerging from long periods of feeling the worst I had ever felt about myself, especially socially and sexually. Both times, I was struggling with a great deal of shame about my romantic life. The over-the-top compliments and the sexually suggestive, sometimes explicit comments seemed to offer up an opportunity to be something other than the sexless, undesirable loser I was scared that I was. In addition to the love bombing, both R and J started immediately talking and acting like we were already in a relationship. From the earliest conversations, they referenced our shared future and began laying out their expectations of me as a romantic partner. Being chosen was difficult for me to resist. I was used to approaching social interactions with a lack of agency, just accepting whatever came along. When someone chose me, it let me off the vulnerability hook. I didn't have to do any work that might involve rejection. Additionally, I didn't feel I had the right to refuse a relationship if someone was insisting on one with me. It was easy for me to overlook the confusion that comes with love bombing, since I was already used to not looking at life from a big picture perspective. Life was just a series of moments that made me feel bad or good, and my goal was to chase the good and avoid the bad. There was an excitement and a relief in being chosen, so I was quick to mirror their love-bombing behaviors. It didn't matter if I had the time or if I was in the middle of something, I felt the need to respond immediately to every communication. In doing so, I was responding to their entitlement with compliance. This compliance may have emboldened them, because alongside the love-bombing, the abusive, controlling behavior began. R figured out that I hadn't had sex before and teased me heavily for it, confirming what was one of my biggest fears at that point, that my sexual inexperience was shameful. Her teasing was condescending and insulting, but at the same time, she suggested that she was going to relieve that shame by having sex with me. It was like dangling a carrot in front of a rabbit to get it to run faster, humiliating but also somehow motivating. Tapping into my sexual shame was extremely effective, but it didn't stop there. Mixed in with her expressions of grandiosity was her utter disapproval, even disdain, for almost everything about me. My history, the way I dressed and carried myself, any opinions I expressed, how I behaved socially. She was sure to include some kind of offset to those comments, like saying how she would go shopping with me to clean up my wardrobe or take me to social events. She was letting me know I was an unattractive loser who should never expect a woman to be interested in me, but she was going to give me a chance. Any resistance on my part was met with more scorn, derision, and insults. Fast forward 8 years to when R and I had decided to divorce but were still living together. This is when I met Jay. Not really met, she reached out to me over social media. In that first conversation, before we even met in person, Jay asked me to denounce R, to swear to her that there was no way the relationship would be rekindled. She created a similar dynamic as R, implying I was a loser for the way I was handling the divorce, and that she was going to come in and dictate how everything should be done. Sex was at the heart of most of the exchange, triggering the sexual shame that had only worsened over the course of my relationship with R. Over the coming weeks, there was an increasing amount of explosive anger and coercive control from Jay. If I didn't do something the way she wanted it done, she would lash out in extreme ways and then punish me with days of hostile treatment. Abuse. From these beginnings, the abuse in both relationships only escalated as the months and years passed. R's style of abuse consisted mostly of belittling, insulting, mocking, and gaslighting me on a daily basis. Gaslighting is a form of manipulation that involves leading a person to doubt their own perception of reality. One example of the many smaller-scale instances of gaslighting is when I would try to push back against her insults. She would claim that she was only joking, that I had no sense of humor, and then ridicule me for that. The next time she insulted me, I would question myself. Am I just being too sensitive? Is she just being funny and I don't get it? That is the point of gaslighting. It is designed to get control over another person by making them doubt themselves, doubt their perception of reality. R's gaslighting was very much tied to her grandiosity and sense of entitlement. She would even tell me how I was feeling about things. No, you're not feeling that, you're feeling this. Because I wasn't in touch with my emotions and habitually deferred to others, it was fairly easy to control me in this way. Like me, R was busy building her own stories about our relationship, and because of her narcissism, it wasn't going to include any sort of personal responsibility on her part. It had to be me that was causing the inevitable issues that we were experiencing as a couple. She eventually decided that everything that was wrong with our relationship was because I lacked confidence in masculinity. She tapped into the entire pool of shame that I had already been carrying and easily convinced me that she was right. I had to make it a quest to get to the bottom of why I lacked confidence in masculinity. It would become a never-ending, soul-crushing fool's errand that would leave me more powerless and hopeless than ever. She reinforced this narrative every day with new rounds of condescending and contemptuous comments that nearly drove me to suicide. By the time I met Jay, R's daily abusive behaviors had trained me to doubt myself in every way. Fawning had become a way of life. Compliance was my only path to safety. Jay's style of abuse was different from R's. Her style involved regular angry outbursts filled with shouting, swearing, insults, and threats. On the rare occasions anger didn't work, or if she sensed it wouldn't work, she would fall back on guilt and manipulation. In the earlier days of the relationship, when she still felt the need to make excuses for her verbal violence, the abuse would often be followed by rationalizations. She felt tired. She felt sick. The people at her workplace were mean to her. We, meaning me, just needed to solve those problems, and then she would treat me well. Jay's ultra-controlling behaviors were ever-present. She would express things in a way that amounted to, if you're going to be with me, this is how you're expected to behave. But then at the same time, it was expected that I would never leave. Some of her behaviors had lasting effects on me, like the way she would curse at me and pound the bed if I moved at all while she was trying to sleep. I became an extremely light sleeper, aware that any movement on my part would provoke an attack. She expected me to do things for her, like drive her car or fold her laundry, then get angry and tell me I was doing everything wrong. Anytime we had to leave the house, she would get extremely frazzled and lash out in some way. I was constantly walking on eggshells and felt the need to be hyper-vigilant at all times in order to not upset her. Trauma bonds. For me, with my unhealed trauma, my history of responding to other people codependently, and my emotional avoidance, The narcissistic abuse was extremely difficult to navigate. There were times during both relationships when I felt suicidal. Like with my friendship with G, leaving the relationship with R never even crossed my mind. With J, I made an early attempt to break it off, but after hours of her crying, arguing, and insisting that she was not going to let me go, I settled in that relationship as well. My system saw their behaviors as threats, because they were threats. But the way I had taught myself to respond to interpersonal threats was to try to defuse them, to comply and fall in line. Fighting back didn't feel like an option, just as it didn't feel like an option when I was a young child navigating how to respond to my dad's angry outbursts or my friend G's attacks. Fleeing didn't feel like an option either, since I would sense the abuser would follow and continue the attack, which in fact is what usually happened. So I froze and I fawned, again and again, from one abusive episode to the next, in an endless, toxic cycle. It's understandably confusing to witness an abusive relationship from the outside. Why would anyone accept abuse day after day and do nothing about it? Why would anyone stand by and allow mistreatment of others? How can these people live with themselves? As details emerge, it may start to make a bit more sense. Maybe the person being abused is afraid for their physical safety if they leave. Maybe they worry about how they'll get by without the abusive person in their lives. They may be fully aware of the situation, but feel alone, powerless, and stuck. Even just reaching out for help is too much of a risk. When it came to my relationships with R and J, it was not a matter of being aware and feeling stuck. It wasn't just a matter of being too afraid to act, although I had a lot of fear in those relationships. Then why did I stay? Certainly my codependent behaviors, my fear of disappointing people, the endless cycle of compliance and seeking approval regardless of the cost to myself played a role. My emotional avoidance also played a role. There was an additional mechanism at play in these two relationships, however, something called a trauma bond. Despite how it sounds, trauma bonding does not refer to the bond people form when they endure a trauma together. It is a term that describes how a person being abused can become inadvertently tied emotionally and psychologically to their abuser, making it that much more difficult to break free of the relationship. A common example is Stockholm Syndrome, where a hostage winds up identifying and empathizing with their captor and supporting their goals. However, this is just one example because a trauma bond can form in any type of abusive relationship. How trauma bonds form. What usually binds people together in an intimate relationship are things like mutual love and affection, shared goals and values, respect and care. But instead, the bonds I experienced with both R and J were rooted in trauma. Their abusive behavior triggered my past trauma and activated the codependent habits that I had formed in response. As the relationships progressed, I endured additional emotional and psychological wounds that further incapacitated me and compromised my ability to break free from the trauma bonds. For a trauma bond to form, there are two critical conditions to be met. First, there's a power imbalance. The person who is being abused feels as though the abuser has most or all of the control in the relationship, leading to feelings of helplessness. On paper, it looked like I had more power in the relationships with R and J. I was physically larger and stronger, I made more money, I was more educated and had more intellectual resources than they did. I didn't feel any of that power. I was used to doubting myself and deferring to others. I had convinced myself that I was powerless. This is why I was particularly vulnerable to narcissistic people, people who felt entitled to having all of the control in the relationship and were ready to violently enforce that position. The other condition that contributes to the trauma bond is the intermittent nature of the abuse. The abusive behaviors aren't constant. There are periods of calm and even care. This intermittency causes confusion for the person being abused, leading them to desperately seek out and hold on to those periods of calm. When an abusive episode ends and the period of calm begins, the person abused may even experience a release of chemical messengers in the brain, ones that influence how they experience pain, pleasure, and reward, further clouding the situation. The trauma bond in each of my romantic relationships had already started to form right from the first conversation. R and J felt entitled to their wants, needs, and desires being prioritized, and I was already trained to do this. They expected validation, and I felt compelled to provide it. They needed their emotions to take center stage, and I was ready to regulate them. They needed to feel control over everything and everyone around them, to feel powerful, and I was ready to turn over my power right from the start. I had to make these relationships work. The intermittent nature of the abuse kept me motivated to avoid words and behaviors that I perceived would lead to abuse, and to capitalize on the moments of calm in every way I could. Authenticity didn't matter. I was in survival mode. I would find myself joining in with their rationalizations, excusing their behaviors towards others, as well as excusing abuse directed at me. They must be right. It must have been my fault. I just need to try harder next time. Every time I gave in and supported the narcissist's abusive behavior, it became that much more acceptable to them. I found that over time, they did less and less work rationalizing their behaviors, while at the same time increasing the level of denial. Once the trauma bond was fully in place, it came to dominate my life. I accepted my abuser's reality and took it on as my own. The more difficult it got with R&J, the harder I would feel the need to try. The abusers became the most important people in my life, sucking up all of my emotional and intellectual resources. Cognitive dissonance. Right from the start, then throughout both of those relationships, I was faced with cognitive dissonance on a regular basis. Cognitive dissonance is a term for the state of discomfort that comes when a person has two or more thoughts that contradict each other. Everyone experiences this, and everyone needs to develop strategies for resolving those contradictions. Feeling cognitive dissonance can often wind up being positive experiences for people if it leads them to challenging their beliefs and changing something about themselves or their life situation that isn't serving them. During the earlier months of my relationship with R, conscious, confusing thoughts regularly popped into my head. An abusive episode would end, and I would notice how the relationship felt nothing like what I had told myself I wanted when I was in the safety of my friendship with E. Similarly, I vividly remember a time when J had stormed out of the house after a particularly violent verbal attack, and I found myself yelling at myself at the top of my lungs, "What the hell are you doing?" My response to these internal conflicts was always the same. Rather than trying to resolve the dissonance, I quickly dismissed the thoughts, tucked away the feelings, then later went on to justify what was happening and to stay the course at all costs. I was doing the work of the abusers myself, even in between the abusive episodes. This is where most of the fawning came in. I was being trained on how to behave from the abusive episodes, and because of my codependency and habitual compliance, I was always looking for ways to do this work. What do I need to change about myself, whether I agree with the change or not? What lie do I need to tell these people to keep them calm or even happy? I needed to believe these lies myself to some extent for them to be believable, for them to stick. When in those relationships, I was no longer a separate individual. My judgment was replaced by theirs, and I didn't have the capacity to imagine anything other than what each of them had told me about who they were, who I was, and what the relationship meant. At no point did I take a step back to think about whether I was actually getting anything out of the relationship. Was I satisfied with my overall situation? Did I feel safe, cared for, understood? How did I really feel about each of them? Were they even the type of people I enjoyed interacting with? Were my days filled with doing things that engaged me, that excited me? Did I start my day and end my day fulfilled and excited to share my experiences with the person I was devoting my entire life to? I was too afraid to ask myself these types of questions because part of me knew that I couldn't handle knowing the answer. Instead of allowing myself to see the reality of what I was experiencing, I was fooling myself into believing I was there for legitimate reasons and that the relationship made sense. I felt the need to defend those relationships as if I was defending myself. If anyone came too close to the truth, I would feel shame and become defensive, resentful. I would occasionally complain about them to other people, but even then I would offer a sanitized version of their behaviors. I was lying to myself, to R&J, and to everyone else on a daily basis about what was really happening, including what I actually felt about both of them. I had taken over the gaslighting to where I was gaslighting myself. Shame and fear. Power and balance and intermittent abuse established the bond. Shame and fear strengthened and protected it. The sources of the fear and shame in those relationships resembled the sources from my childhood. the invalidation of my needs and desires, feeling unloved, feeling unable to protect myself or others. I excused R and J's bad behaviors as best I could, both the ones directed at me and the ones directed at others. I became a sidekick to their mistreatment of others. Once again, I was the scared boy who was standing slightly behind G, fake laughing while he abused other people, this time including people who were important to me. I rationalized and told stories as a way to manage the constant fear, shame, and cognitive dissonance that I was experiencing. But all this did was keep me suspended in a state of ignorance, leading to even more fear and shame. I then felt the overwhelming need to avoid that fear and shame too, creating a closed, self-perpetuating system. The ball of unresolved emotions that I was already carrying became larger and more unmanageable. As when I was younger, I suffered from depression and anxiety during those relationships, but those were treated like problems to be medicated, not signals that something was wrong with my life. I'm not saying that I was just some innocent victim in these relationships. My behaviors were dishonest and self-seeking. I was inauthentic, resentful, and often controlling and manipulative in my own ways. Because so much of my emotional bandwidth was occupied by being on constant threat alert, I had a really hard time staying present, especially when being actively triggered, which I was on almost a continuous basis. I wasn't present for myself, and I wasn't present for anyone else in my life. I was at full emotional capacity, and it was difficult for me to empathize with others. My emotional signals were trying to alert me to these facts, but my impulse was to avoid the signals and bury the fallout. Relationship endings. The trauma bond with R was incredibly strong, and I was in a state of delusion. As far as I was concerned, it was a completely legitimate relationship that I was trying to fix by somehow becoming more confident and masculine. Everyone I knew seemed to be fully on board, not only with the relationship, but with her. People I had known my entire life bought into her vision, not just of who she was, but how she had stepped in and made me a better person. I was full of unconscious shame that I was the one failing the relationship and fear of what that meant. I was afraid of her and ashamed of the way she treated me, but I was unable to sit with those emotions and incorporate them into an honest picture of my life and my experiences. When R said she wanted a divorce, my first reaction was feelings of rejection, followed by more shame of failure. I was able to escape those feelings by distracting myself, mostly with thoughts of what I would do next, how I could now make decisions for myself on where I wanted to live, and what to do with my days. I felt a sense of relief, but not because I would soon be free of daily abuse. I wasn't able to admit to myself that abuse was even part of my experience. Really, I was mostly experiencing relief that I would no longer need to be performing and failing to perform for R. I was the one that eventually ended the relationship with J and asked for a divorce, but with very little agency on my part. J had asked for an open marriage, and in opening the relationship, a lot more people were able to observe J's behaviors firsthand. What I was working so hard at hiding from myself and other people, that this was an abusive, dysfunctional relationship with a narcissistic partner, was coming to light. The shame of being in that relationship was getting more and more difficult to avoid. Ultimately, the growing sense of shame I experienced about remaining in the relationship came to outweigh the fear of leaving it. It was not easy to end the relationship with Jay. Even after I had decided to do so, I was terrified of actually going through with it. It was well beyond the usual fear I felt when faced with potentially disappointing someone. I couldn't even articulate what the fear was. Really, I could barely even admit to myself that it was even fear. As I often did, I was paralyzing myself with what-ifs. I was having fake conversations in my head about what to say if she replied in a certain way. I expected the conversation to resemble litigation in a court case, where I'd have to make my case as to why I wanted out. Anytime the fear grew too intense, I found myself trying to sever my emotions and reduce it all to some kind of checklist of pros and cons, justifications for why I needed to leave the relationship, or why I was even entitled to. Ultimately, the divorce conversation with Jay was much more spontaneous than I had imagined. She was trying to plan a future vacation, and I was being noticeably awkward and hesitant. When she asked me what was going on, I said, "I don't see a future for this relationship." Far simpler than I had planned, but it served its purpose and produced the expected result. She exploded. I then mostly just let her dump her anger, bitterness, and guilt on me. I was in a free state and let her rage. But I wasn't free of the trauma bond just yet. In some ways, it only got more intense. I still felt responsible for her. I still let her dictate how things would play out, what she was entitled to. She would remind me regularly that she didn't want the relationship to end, that she was owed some kind of compensation. Her controlling behaviors continued, in some ways getting worse, including threats and attacks. I was still full of fear and desperately searching for ways to escape with as little damage as I possibly could. Not only was I still trapped in the effects of the trauma bonds with R&J, the shame and trauma I was already carrying since childhood had compounded, adding several new layers. In some cases, those layers were quite a bit more intense, reaching areas of my life that trauma had yet to really affect, like sex or finances. My behaviors in response had correspondingly become more complex and deeply embedded.
And that concludes Chapter 4. We hope you'll join us in a couple of weeks. And again, if you would be so kind to leave a review on Amazon, we would much appreciate it.